Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Bob Brill. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Stand. When the good Lord hits you, gonna hit you like a ton of lead. When the good Lord hits you, gonna hit you like a ton of lead. Beat down on your knees and believe in every word he said.
That is Tommy Womack and Up Memphis Blues, and I couldn't think of a more appropriate song for tonight's
Perfect.
Book. Okay, it's another Thursday evening. This is, of course, LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block, and I am your host, Jim Christina, and I'm studio with nobody, with a whole bunch of empty chairs. But I do have Bobby Jean on the line, so Bobby, say hello.
I'm here.
Goody, goody, goody. But let's get the major stuff out of the way, and then we'll get our guest right in because she's so much fun and she's very interesting. Okay, for you new writers out there, and I'm sure that there are a bunch of you, you've typed your final period. You've stacked your last chapter. You sat back in your chair and you said to yourself, whew, I'm done. Nope, not even close. Sure, you finished your manuscript, but it takes a whole lot more work to have a completed book. You know what it takes? It takes editing, and then it takes rewriting, and more editing, and more rewriting, and formatting, proofreading, and more rewriting. Then, if you're lucky, you can devise a cover and get some printed. And, well, why not let the folks at Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books do that for you? For a very small investment, we can do all of the above and get you the finished printed book you dreamt about when you first started typing and help you get some dollars in your pockets as well. We are here for new writers that don't have the foggiest idea of what they're doing, and having learned it, we can share and help you get a book of which you can be proud. So give us a call at 805-795-3165 or email me at jchristina, that's C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, at TuscanyBayBooks.com or R. Paolinelli, that's P-A-O-L-I-N-E-L-L-I, at TuscanyBayBooks.com. Or if you want, you can just email us and send us a manuscript and let us take a look at it and see if we can help you navigate through it. And Bobby Jean, why don't you tell us about what's going on your side of the world?
You know, there's only 17 weeks left to Christmas, so it's not too soon to start thinking about that gift list. And Out West Shop is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and Western lifestyle. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, fashion accessories, boots, home decor, and general merchandise. National brands include Rockmount Ranchwares, the Scully Leather Company, American West Handbags, and Dan Post Boots, just to name a few. Shop online at www.outwestshop.com. Enter code WB100 and receive $10 off your order. Or just call me toll-free, 1-877-340-9378. We like to say it's always a great day out west.
Wow. I like the way you do that. You do much better than I do. Okay. Our writer tonight is the author of A Portal in Time, Dancing to an Irish Reel, and now Morning Dove. She is also the author of Through an Autumn Window, a novella included in the book Southern Seasons, to be published in October by Firefly Southern Fiction, a two-time award winner of the Faulkner Society's Words and Music William Wisdom Contest. Claire Fullerton's work has appeared repeatedly in Southern Writers Magazine, the Dead Mule School of Southern Literature, and Celtic Life International. Claire hails from Memphis and now lives in Malibu, California. She is represented by Julie Gwynn of the Seymour Literary Agency. Would you please welcome back to the Writer's Block, Miss Claire Fullerton. See, Claire, you even get the clap.
Thank you for the applause. I am so happy to be back with you, Jim and Bobby.
Oh, we're so happy to have you with us. You're such a hoot, and you're such a good friend of the show.
This is my Writer's Block radio show reunion, and I couldn't be more thrilled to be with you.
Well, golly, thanks. It's like I said, but Claire and I had a conversation the other night, and I'm still blushing. She's just the greatest. She's just the greatest.
I shamelessly flattered you. That's what I did.
You shamelessly flattered me.
I have the greatest respect for you, Jim, Christina. I always have.
Well, and I'm for you, Claire Fullerton. So now that we've got the welcoming mats over with and everybody's back is patted. In fact, my arm still hurts from patting myself on the back from Tuesday. I ran out in the family room and told Jerry that, oh, my God, you should hear what Claire Fullerton said. And she just looked at me and she goes, so?
She's no longer charmed, I imagine.
No, she is, actually. So anyway, your new book, Morning Dove, of course, is a tale of a Southern young lady in the early 60s. And she is, of course, of a family that is broken, but her mother came from, I guess, gentried positions in Memphis. Would that be close to being accurate?
Yes, it would be, Jim. And it actually begins in the year of 1970 when two siblings are relocated from Minnesota, the lake area of Minnesota,
right,
into their mother's southern, genteel, rather aristocratic world of manners and form in Memphis, Tennessee.
Right.
And it's a coming-of-age story is what it is, cause and effect. A bit of the sins of the father was passed down in generations.
Right,
and,
right.
Yes, it's a Southern family saga is what it is.
Well,
set in 1970s Memphis.
It's a coming of age for both the brother and the sister.
Because
it doesn't really focus on either or. It focuses on both, which is quite the accomplishment because, I mean, it keeps you interested in both their lives.
Yes, thank you, Jim. Yes, it is. Exemplary of the bond between siblings,
mm-hmm,
and the coming of age as they grow up. And we find as the book moves along that they come to disparate ends. And so the idea was to say, how can it be that two siblings can be cut from the same cloth, if you will, have the same history,
mm-hmm,
and yet come to such different ends?
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And further, mm-hmm, why does that happen?
Well, I think it happens in a lot more families than we might think. I think siblings are very close in the early years, and as they age and grow older and get their own lives going, and it's not so much important to be around the other one anymore.
Yeah, this could be true. I've seen it both ways,
mm-hmm,
and I've always been fascinated with the subject of what a family unit,
mm-hmm,
produces if it's intact throughout the ages, or if for whatever reason,
mm-hmm,
it's torn asunder, and then what happens to the members of the family. And you know, it's nothing new for any writer to want to examine the question, is it nature or is it nurture that contributes to who we become in life?
See, that's a good question.
And, yeah, I mean, and I think that there's nothing new at all with that question.
No.
But that having been said, to take that subject matter, but yet try to intersperse it or weave it through with the setting of the South as it was in the 70s, where people back then adhered to certain social mores and a code of and manner of being, a certain gentility that was observed as a culture.
Mm-hmm.
But yet the players, without them being campy or, you know, or intentionally gratuitously eccentric, you know, I didn't want to go there,
mm-hmm,
with the Southern thing, but yet to make them the characters, the diverse and the dynamic and the charismatic characters that they were, and to be able to write the book in scenes that told the story episodically, like in one scene after the next, that told how it was in the Southern culture in the 70s up until the 80s. And they were changing times, you know, culturally, politically, every way. It was a very tumultuous time because it was immediately out of the era of the civil rights movement.
Right, right.
And so
right.
You have a little bit of the readjusting that was going on in that setting as well. And so how to tell a good story engaging about people without it being heavy or dark or dramatic. That for me was what I felt that I should deftly handle in writing Mourning Dove was how to bring that all together in one novel.
Well, I noticed that your protagonist, the female, she had a hard time equating the African American servants in her household to civil rights movement, and I noticed several times that she mentioned that she was having issues with that, and she couldn't quite understand why they stayed or why they didn't stay. She was just confused, I think, and I'm not too sure if I hit that on the nose or not, but it seemed to me that's what she was doing.
Well, I think that culturally, that paradigm was going to be different in the South than it was in the North.
Well, absolutely,
where this brother and sister came from, and so it was new to them, and so the task for me was to tell it as the narrator saw it in the moment, and the thoughts that would cross her mind without making a statement about it one way or the other. You know, that I made no claims one way or the other in that book. Rather, they were observations as they crossed the mind of Millie Crossan, the narrator of the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And her brother's name was, again?
Finley.
Finley, yes.
We all want a Finley in our lives.
Oh, thank you.
I had one. It was
that
me.
That was my hope. That was my hope.
I digested, devoured, relished this book as I did both of your first two. You pack so much in, but one doesn't feel that it's overdone. I think there's such talent there. You give us through the eyes of Millie. She's very observant. And I wonder, did Millie keep journals? Because Millie is writing when she's, I guess, about 36. She's kind of looking back and recapturing all of these events and people and parties and what the women are wearing and the drinks that are being drunk and the food on the tables. And I just thought, you know, she must be sitting up in her room late at night, writing down all of her thoughts about what went on today.
In a drunken stupor, because she was drinking, you know, too.
In order to recapture it so beautifully. You write with such love. All of these characters, her mom, Posey. Tell us about Posey. She's remarkable. Tell us about her.
I wanted to make Posey a composite of all the wonderful, beautiful, elegant, seraphic creatures that populated my coming of age in Memphis. I found these women engaging. They were queens. They dressed to the nines. They were delightful, always. I never saw any of them in a bad mood or in the midst of a histrionic episode. It was just not the ilk of the way that I experienced the South. And so what I wanted to do with Posey, what was to make her beautiful, but to make her a little removed and distant and almost self-absorbed, little bit of a narcissist in terms of she wanted her world to be very specific. She wanted to do well. She wanted to live well. She wanted to be well, and all was well because Posey made it so. And with a smile on her face. And I think that my heartfelt opinion about the Southern women, and a lot of them are like this to this day, but they certainly were, I think, during the era in which I set Mourning Dove, the 70s, you know, in that era, that they were women to the manner born. Mm-hmm. And there was a certain innate gentility that they were all possessed of because they were raised by women that were just that. And so this is my opinion, but I do think that that generation, the people coming up in the 1970s, I would say, well, that to me is the generation that was raised by the real last of the Southern Belles. Mm-hmm. And I say that because that generation that raised those in the 70s were seriously raised by Southern Belles.
Right.
And if you think about the manners and the form of how it could be in Victorian England, for instance, where as a culture, that type of manner and form meant everything. It dictated. It didn't just rule society. It dictated society.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the South, if you think about it, being as it was, that it was settled by the English and the Scotch-Irish primarily, as far as the Caucasians went, that was the background and that was what was passed down. And, you know, it keeps coming back to gentility. And, you know, I can tell you I've been in California for more than 20 years now, but, you know, I say it with pride that the women I know, my contemporaries down south, that they're still that way to a very large degree, mm-hmm. you know. And that's my opinion of the South. And so to speak to your question, I think that Posey was a product of the times and a product of the ways and means from which she was raised. Mm-hmm. And they all wanted to keep that culture, firmly ensconced, because they liked it. It was what they knew. So,
well,
and
the home, 79 Kensington Park, it's like a character, you know, a character in this book.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that, because I wanted that setting to really be a character, that I wanted the reader to be so familiar with every hallway and with both staircases and with what was down in the basement that I kept revisiting over and over. I kept walking the reader through the rooms in order to get from the card room to the kitchen. You had to go through the parlor, through the dining room, or the back hall.
Right.
I wanted the reader to be as familiar with that setting, because a sense of place, I believe, in a novel really anchors the entire story.
I liked your comment when she went back to visit 79 Kensington Place as an adult, and she went to the card room and they had carpeted the floor. And she thought to herself, oh, my mother would never do that. I mean, these people don't have the intelligence to pull the rug up in the summertime to make it cooler.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to use the line, it's a pity they didn't know how to do.
Right.
You know, because that is quintessentially Southern. When you say, oh, these poor people don't know how to do, you know, that says it all. I mean, it's the biggest insult you could possibly give anybody. Would be to say, well, they don't know how to do.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, bless their heart.
it's quite leveling.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that was part of the fun with writing Mourning Dove. As I prepared, I knew that I had the story, and I had the beginning, the middle, and the end.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did as I started writing it, I might have been about 25 pages in, and I started writing down as they came to me, and I could be anywhere when a line or just a turn of phrase that I thought was quintessentially Southern that I wanted to use, and I ended up having written down these lines, I ended up creating scenes so that I could use one line, for instance. And I wanted to use a line with regard to the colonel, who's the nemesis for all intents and purposes in the story. You know, you have to have a, you have to have the conflict, and you have to have the nemesis.
Right.
And so I gave it all to the colonel, and I wanted Ida Ella Morgan to deliver the line, "Oh, he too mean to die," because I loved that line.
Me too.
I thought that was the greatest line, and I actually heard that line growing up, and I worked an entire scene in the kitchen so that Ida Ella Morgan could deliver that line.
Yes, you did.
And I found myself doing that quite a few times in Mourning Dove, just because I wanted to deliver that line.
Well, Ella was a wonderful character, and she was kind of like the conscience of the entire family.
I think so.
And you know, a real telling thing with the mom was when they were sitting in the kitchen, and Ella looked at her, and she goes, "I don't know why you stay with that man." And the mother looks at her and she goes, "Because he takes care of me." And I thought, whoa, now that tells a story right there.
Do you think so? No, tell us why you think so, Jim.
Because I think that when she moved down there, she wasn't sure. I mean, she knew her roots, but she wasn't sure how she was going to make it back into society. And when she married the colonel, it was an automatic push in. Because he was the dean of the school.
How insightful of you. Yes.
Well, and it also let all of her lady friends relax a bit because
she wasn't after their husbands.
She was being taken care of, looked after by some of the chivalrous husbands of her lady friends. And I'm sure that those that were, you know, remained were very happy when she found that she now had a permanent escort.
Well, you know what? It's funny that you said that, Bobby, because as I was reading that whole section, I was thinking to myself, now, this woman is drop-dead gorgeous. Even her daughter says so. And the women around Memphis are saying so. And she has no male escort. And their husbands, of course, are gladly volunteering, and they're going over and doing work at her house and staying there. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, these women had to have been worried about something for real because...
Well, a couple move away. Well, one anyway moves away.
Yeah. One of them, she packed his ass up and moved him out. So
You definitely caught that. And part of my aim in the way that I wrote Mourning Dove was to suggest things without really saying it. And because I wanted the reader to divine. Mm-hmm. And readers are intelligent people. And one of the things I always aim for is to never insult the reader by giving them too much. And, you know, give them the gift of being able to, you know, divine and discern what it is that's going on without the writer saying it, you know, because that takes all the fun out of it. But I can tell you that you both completely understood what I was trying to say about Posey, about the mother, and that she was rather coquettish and rather threatening to other women. But again, this is the South, and nobody's going to come out and say that.
Right. And she was a healthy woman, and she had, you know, desires of any healthy woman.
Looks and charm.
There you go.
And it can be a dangerous combination if you have a will that is self-serving.
There you go.
Know, and if that's your aim, you'll move heaven and earth to manifest your intention. And who's ever in the way, better get out of your way. You know, so it was that kind of idea. Posey ended up growing as I wrote her.
She did.
She did.
And I ended up finding my way more firmly into who she was. And again, I think it's because I wrote the book in scenes that I visually could see scenes play out with the characters in it and the people in it. And I knew what I wanted to say. I knew what the aim of each scene was. But when you're writing dialogue, you know, you're winging it, completely winging it.
Absolutely.
And it all happens at once. And for me, it happens very quickly. You know, I don't struggle or labor when I'm writing something. If I'm writing, you know, a scene. Now, if I get to the end of a scene, I may say, okay, now where is this going next? And I may have to, you know, pull that one together with a bit of a pause. But while I'm writing a scene, it's always, you know, a very fluid experience for me. And so what you read in the book of Morning Dove with regard to the dialogue and the scenes, that was very easy for me because I had them all in a specific area in Memphis. We're down at Tom Lee Park, which is on the bluffs of the Mississippi River in Memphis, or we're in the card room of 79 Kensington Park or the Memphis Country Club or any of that. But for me, all I needed was the setting. Mm-hmm. And the rest almost created itself.
Mm-hmm. When one of the things that I really enjoyed too was you keep sharing some new things. Like, we don't know right off the bat that Finley is an amazing guitar player. We get to know Finley for, unless I'm mistaken here, about 70 pages. We learn a lot about Millie and Finley and this world that they live in, and then they go in a record store, and all of a sudden we're learning that actually Finley's been involved with music for quite a while. Mm-hmm. sooner in his life than when we begin to have this part of it be a big piece of his life. But we go into this record store. It's a wonderful scene. For many reasons, and one is that Millie sees her brother with she adores him. We know that from page one, from the first sentence, and she describes him many times throughout the book. But there's always a new nuance and a new description. And in this record store, this musty record store, she sees him like anew. And she catches his hair in a new light, and she sees him talking music and with a guy that owns the store that knows him, who obviously recognizes his talent. And she kind of steps back a little, like, oh, this is another Finley that I didn't, you know, that I didn't really know. And I'm going to bask in being his sister. It's a really cool, it's a wonderful scene.
But I think we do that in real life, that we can grow so used to somebody, so accustomed to their presence, and we create a dynamic that is personal, insular, certainly. But it's when we go out into public and we see them exchanging with somebody we might not know, mm-hmm. and suddenly it dawns how everybody else might be looking at, you know, our sibling in this case. And I know that I've always been capable of doing that, but by nature, I'm a bit of an observer anyway. I watch people. I'm fascinated by people and their mannerisms and all of this. And so that, to me, I thought the reason why I wrote it that way is because I can't be the only person that does that, that, you know, you're with your mate or your sibling or a parent, and you see them in conversation and you're just watching them, and you think suddenly, you know, it dawns on you, you're absolutely fascinating, mm-hmm. you know, to the untrained eye. Well, and so I like the idea of that. And I think that it's quite common. Uh-huh. And that's the reason why I wrote that scene that way.
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do too with, you also, for the first time, you see your sibling as his friends see him. Mm-hmm. And it's a shock, but it's a wake up. Like, he's not just your brother. He's has friends, and he's a different person to those people, or with those people.
Or in this case, Millie was saying, you know, Finley does not just belong to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know that other people in the wider world have a taste of him. And because Finley, I had it in the very beginning of the book that he started playing the guitar when he was 8 years old. And so and I made it so he was the kind of character that anything he put his mind to, he ended up mastering, mm-hmm. pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. And he did it scholastically. and he did it musically, and you know, any pursuit that caught his attention, he was just one of these characters that could do pretty much anything and do it well if he put his mind to
right,
it.
And, right.
And so that's what that was about. And the idea of Finley, now as we are further into the 1970s, with regard to the scene that Bobby just referred to in the record store, it was almost new to Millie to discover that her brother had been sneaking out at night and going down a street called Madison. I'm sorry, y'all. That's my Cortana going off. But sneaking out to a gritty club in the unpopulated side of Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, he's sort of coming into his own and making his way in a world that was foreign to the manicured, genteel side of Memphis that Posey aimed to raise her children in. And so Finley, in that serendipitous way that young boys do, ferreted out his own little version of 1970s Memphis. And he did it through, you know, what was immediately at hand. And that's the music scene in Memphis. And so I wanted it to be like that, because boys will be boys. And they will find, you know, their little area where they fit in, and they don't need anybody's permission. And if they have to sneak out at night, well, then they sneak out at night and they get it done.
There you go.
And so that's what that was about. That I think young boys, any young boy worth his salt, sooner or later comes into his own by his own volition.
Absolutely.
And so that's what that was about.
I have to cut you off right here, Claire. I have to do a commercial.
Okay.
And we'll be back in, I'd say less than a minute. So hang tough. Don't go away. Bobby Jean, of course, you know what to do. And we're going to be doing that right now. So here we go. Imagine deep blue skies, majestic mountains and acres of lush green orange trees in a tranquil country setting. Sound like a perfect vacation spot? Well, it is, for your dog. That's right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Whether you are going away for a one- or two-night getaway or an extended vacation, All Dogs Rule is the place your dog wants to be when they can't be with you. When your dogs return home, you'll have to ask, whose vacation was better? Well, we all know the answer to that. It's your dog's. So check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you. Russ and Karen will thank you. And, everybody will be happy. That's All Dogs Rule at alldogsrule.com. And we are back. It is now 7:33. We are on the phone with Claire Fullerton, the writer that's Morning Dove and Dancing to an Irish Reel. And she's just a quintessential girl writer. She's great. If you want to call and talk to Claire, now here, Claire, this is where your friends get a chance to really bust your butt. 818-602-4929. Again, that number in the studio is 818-602-4929, and I promise not to hang up on you. Okay. I have hung up on so many of them, Claire, you can't believe it. And Bobby Jean will attest that I am not lying.
Absolutely true.
Absolutely. Take it.
Claire, as we've been talking about, this book is just delightful, and we turn the pages and we relish each and every word and sentence. We get to the first paragraph of chapter 25.
Okay.
And Millie asks a lot of questions. And
I am turning in my book to that right now.
It's the very first paragraph of chapter 25. And I have to tell you that when I read this paragraph, I felt like Millie was somehow, she was right inside my heart. I wasn't a reader anymore. She was making me she was making me confront my own life. And I think that's also a remarkable thing when an author does that, and it's not a self-help book or a, you know, motivational book or a a religious book, but within the context of this story, she asks these really deep questions, and I have read and reread this paragraph many times. If you have would you like to read it?
I'll read it. You are such a professional broadcaster. You just thrill me. I have it in my hand, and here we go.
Okay.
Chapter 25 of Morning Dove. What is the fire of inspiration that resides within, if not something to follow along a path? What happens when a person thinks they've discovered their purpose in life, only to see it come to a disillusioning end? How does a dream die? Does the death of a dream when it's nurtured with heart and soul mean a person's been on the wrong path all along? If we can't choose our life's purpose, then what mysterious force bestows us with our path to destiny? If we can't see and hear the mysterious force, then how are we to decipher its guiding clues? What are we to do with our good intentions once their application comes to naught? Are we to concede a lack of understanding, dust ourselves off, and embark upon another path, hoping to get it right the next time? I never considered these questions until the course of Finley's life brought them to the fore.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to, beyond telling the story, I wanted to interject what Millie is thinking about the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I went into Morning Dove, I considered its themes, because I knew that whatever I was going to really decide upon, I had to hold firm to, as if it were a thread. And I had to hold that thread from page one until the last page. And I ended up deciding that Morning Dove has three themes, and they are a search for place, a search for identity, and a search for God. And I think that these are three questions that sooner or later everybody mulls over. And so I wanted to put them all in the book, which is to say, Millie is telling the story of what came of her brother, with whom she grew up side by side. And I've already said, without giving it away, that the brother and sister came to disparate ends. And I've already said earlier, the question is, how does this happen? And further, why does this happen? And so, with regard to a search for identity, a search for place, and a search for God, I maintain that sooner or later, every human being gets around to asking these questions. And so I ask them unabashedly in Morning Dove. And I think it's interesting for me, y'all, because the last time I talked to y'all, it was a great time talking about Dancing to an Irish Reel, which was published in 2015. And I remember, even as I wrote that book, holding back with regard to really coming out with both barrels blazing and asking questions like I did in Morning Dove. And so I feel as if I got braver as a writer. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't get braver, well, then I got more unabashed, mm-hmm. you know, and less apologetic. And so I just, you know, came out swinging with, all right, here's the questions. What in the world is going on? And how does this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And who's in charge?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much the point of Morning Dove. And I think that, you know, writers, you know, mostly enter a project, in this case, a novel, you know, enter a project with an aim or a question. And you've got to ask that question and perhaps answer it. Certainly you're responsible for exploring it through story, and that to me is the point of writing a novel. And for me, I always want to say something, You know, whether or not I do it well is anybody's guess, but that's what I'm trying to do. And thus far in my career, I have yet to write, you know, an entertaining story for the sake of writing an entertaining story. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of writers that do, and they do it well. But I found that part of the business of being an author, you know, the writer of novels, is that you get in touch with who you are, what you've got to say, and what your process is, you know, and then you hold fast to that, and it keeps me myopically focused. Mm-hmm. And I'm not looking over my shoulder at who's doing what, when, and how they're doing it. That for me, you know, I really need to just stay the course of what my vision is and my aim, and then do it. And then we'll see what comes of it. Mm-hmm. You know, if that makes sense.
Right. So, now, if there are any new writers out there, I hope you are taking notes. Because what you just heard.
And I think you've got to be that way. And unless, you know, I mean, I've said this before to you, Jim. I remember saying this last time. I remember saying, it's not as if I ever set out to be a writer.
Right.
What I did instead was I got in touch with the fact that I am one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's different. You know, I'm not trying to write commercial fiction for the sake of, you know, let's make some money or any of that. That's not what I'm about.
Right.
So far, you know, I mean,
I don't know.
It may change 20 years.
But
for right now, that's where I am.
I honestly don't know, Claire, many writers who do write for money. They write to tell a story and to get their story out there. I most writers I know, and you're included in that, I mean, it's nice to make a buck or two. I mean, good Lord. I mean, you know, why not? It's not illegal. But it's nice to get your story out there as well and have people read it and like it and get it.
Yeah. Well, that's the hope, is that something will come of it. You know,
right.
And I think it's that way in all things.
Sure.
Than anybody puts their energy to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You want to produce something. You want something good to come from it.
Well,
you know, the fruits
sure.
of your labor.
Sure,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Especially if you're in the artistic world, a musician and an artist would say the same thing. I need to. It would be nice if it paid me enough to, you know, survive. But
absolutely,
I'm not in it for the money. Is not what I'm
right.
in it for. You know, I'm driven. I'm compelled by some type of spirit that's taking me, you know, onward, that I have to do this. I'm called to do this.
Right. Well,
yeah, exactly. What is the fire of inspiration that resides within?
Go.
What is it?
There,
what is
there
it?
You go.
You know,
there you
where
go.
Does it come from?
Mm-hmm.
We've spent a little bit too much time on your novel, so I need to get this out quick, and then Bobby's going to ask you the question. What advice do you have for a new writer?
Oh, I think that if you feel compelled to do it, that's reason enough to do it, and do it with full commitment. And my best advice for any new writer is to really allow yourself to grow in the process, to just begin and tell the complete story, even if it's a first person essay,
mm-hmm.
you know, 800 words
mm-hmm.
or 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to pay attention to that beginning, middle, and end. And I think that all writers, it's liberating to keep in mind that there is no there to get to with writing. It's only the process that develops the writer. And
mm-hmm.
so, again, my best advice is to just, you know, engage with the process of it, and to put it simply, sit down and write.
There.
You know, tell your story.
That's what we tell
no
them
matter
to.
How long it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn by doing. I
That's
think.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. Bobby, why don't you ask the question?
Well, you know this show, Claire. We have to ask the question about writer's block. Do you get it? If not, why not? Or and how do you get around it?
I don't know that I've ever had a block, because I've always felt the living, breathing force of a novel while I'm in it. But That said, there have been times when I've gotten to the end of a scene. I know what the arc of the book is, and I know where it's going. But the question that I've been up against before is, where do I go next? Mm-hmm. And that's usually going to be somewhere in the middle of the book. And how I get out of that is I remind myself that every scene that I write in a book has the purpose of furthering the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes for me, okay, so what next will further the point that I'm trying to make? And so, as I said earlier, it helps to have a full grasp on what you're trying to say in the novel. What's the point of the story? What do you want the reader to take away from them? You know, and so again, it becomes, what is another case in point to the larger picture? You know, mm-hmm. how can I create that? Again, say it without saying it. You know, so that's the writer's hesitation. I think it's just really, you know, musing upon or mulling it over the best way to, again, present a case in point. You know, because I wanted Morning Dove to be basically, you know, let's give the reader one episodic train wreck after another. Let's just line them
well,
up.
Well, you
let's
did that.
One train wreck because I wanted the reader to get to the end of the book without giving it away.
Yes, but we can't give it away.
Huh?
We can't give it away because it's got
a
twisty turny ending.
I can see how this happens. At the end of the book, I wanted the reader to very compassionately and very emotionally respond with, well, of course, I can see how this happened. The signs were there all along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was breadcrumbs. And I think that most readers will get to the end of a book and reflect.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, so I wanted that reflection to be, I can see how this happened. And so anyway, full circle to your question about the writer's block, or in it, not so much a block as it is an opportunity to sort of regroup, get centered and say, okay, we've come through this. Where shall we go next? That is a case in point to the larger, you know, question of the book, if you will.
I can absolutely. Yeah,
I'm not afraid at all. I've written four novels and a novella. So I have another full manuscript after Morning Dove, and you did mention the novella, which I want to talk about very briefly. But
well, we're running out of time. We actually only have about a minute left, so.
Oh, okay.
We're going to have to schedule another time.
Off.
Well, I'm not going to cut you off, Claire. I'm just going to hang up on you. Well, this is a good reason. This is a good reason for you to book another hour with Jerry and come in and we'll talk about your novella.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great.
So that'd be great.
Make that happen, girlfriend.
Yeah, you all are doing so well that you're booked all the way up through the year.
Yeah, we are. We are. Actually, we're booked through January.
Congratulations.
Now. Thank you so much.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure doing this show. Mostly because we get to meet really cool authors like you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you so much, you all, for having me.
Oh, you know what? Why don't you give our listeners a real quick rundown of where they can find you, website and email address and all the good stuff?
Okay. Well, I'm on Twitter, @ C. Fullerton 3, and I'm on Instagram, which I love Instagram, and I use my initials @ CF Fullerton.
Okay.
And Facebook, Claire Fullerton Author is my author page. I'm on Pinterest under Claire Fullerton. I'm pretty much everywhere. I have a blog on WordPress called Writing Notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in this day and age, all you have to do is type in Claire Fullerton and everything.
Oh, yeah. You get
the
Google
website.
Google shoots up there.
ClaireFullerton.com. has it all right there.
There you go. Well, Claire, thank you so much for agreeing to be with us for another evening. And as
it's
always,
it's been a complete pleasure.
It's always fun having you on the show, and you're so full of insight and so full of good advice. And actually, you gave me the ending to the book I'm writing. So.
How did I do that? How in the world did I do that?
I will send you an email and explain it to you.
Now, don't send me an email. Thank me in the credits of your book.
Done deal. Oh, you know what? I can do that.
I'd rather have that. Send your email. I want public credit.
There you go. Okay, we got to go. Thank you so much, Claire.
Okay, Jim and Bobby. All the best.
Have a great evening. Go have a glass of wine.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Talk soon. Bye-bye. Gosh, she's so much fun, isn't she, Bobby?
Oh, my gosh. This was such a remarkable book.
And she's just a remarkable author. She's just so good. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we have wonderful authors on, and Claire is, like, probably one of the top 10%. Easily.
Just wonderful.
She is. Next week, we have Johnny Barnhart. Her book is called The Good Girl, and I don't know if you've started reading it yet.
Tonight, I will.
I did. Well, I did today, and it's so far, it's pretty good.
Yes.
So we'll talk with Johnny next week. I believe she's a Texas girl. And I got to watch Bob Brill's show, a movie.
You did on Monday night?
No, I didn't go. I actually got it. I got a link to it and watched it on video. I'll send you the link.
Oh, great.
So, Bobby Jean, it's always a pleasure seeing you and talking to you. Well, talking to you, at least. And,
all right.
And, of course, Bob isn't here tonight. I don't know what he's doing. He's off doing Brill stuff. And tune in on Friday at Channel 2, or actually CBS, whenever your Judge Judy show is on Friday. Tune in, because Russ, he's got a segment on there. It's in the second half hour.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he was on Judge Judy, poor guy.
Tomorrow. So that's tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow. 31st.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, with that being said, for Bobby Jean Bell and myself, Jim Christina, this is The Writer's Block. And, of course, we've killed another Thursday, so we are kind of out of here.